The program, co-hosted by myself, Andre Lopez Turner, and Juan Toledo, the editor of Revista Perro Negro and Artefacto, welcomes Gillian Edelstein, photographer, documentarian, human rights activist, and so much more. The Royal Photographic Society named Gillian as one of the 100 heroines across the world transforming photography, but that is just one of her numerous worldwide awards. Gillian's portraits have appeared in Vogue, The New Yorker, Time Magazine, Vanity Fair, Guardian, Financial Times, Forbes, GQ, Esquire, and various other magazines. Her photographs have been exhibited in the National Portrait Gallery, Sotheby's, the Photographers Gallery, the Royal Academy, Robben Island Museum, Dali International Photography Festival in the Yunnan province in China. Gillian has documented the South African Truth and Reconciliation Commission, publishing an extraordinary book called Truth and Lies About This, which won the Visdor in Perpignan and is highly acclaimed. Gillian also judged the World Press Awards in 2014, and Gillian's bio is even bigger than that, but we could be here all evening. But anyway, we are very honoured at the program in Artefacto to have her on our show, which will be streamed on ztrradio.podomatic.com as a podcast and on YouTube. And without further ado, sounding too American, welcome, welcome. Thank you for coming, Gillian.
Thank you very much for having me. I'm deeply honoured to be with
you. No, we are honoured. Gillian, just before the program, we were talking about photojournalism and documentarist. Do you see a difference between the two? What are the similarities and what are the differences, if there are any? I know it could be a very difficult question, but do you see it? Because before you answer, and I was thinking about this, could be a process of change. Could be that photojournalism is disappearing somehow and people are becoming documentarists. I don't know. That was a thought, a not very well-developed thought, I have to say.
No, it is an interesting thought, and I'm not sure that I don't see documentary work as something that's more self-initiated. For some reason, I think I've always seen photojournalism as being attached to the print media. And of course, and what you're suggesting is that that media is fast evaporating. Mm-hmm. When I say fast, my hands are going very slowly, so slow, but it's a rather alarming thing, and I think, and we all know, that very kind of qualitative magazines and newspapers are struggling to survive. And I think that photojournalists that we saw attached to, whether it was Life or Time magazine or, you know, the different newspapers, are having really to kind of rely very much on their own drive and vision. Mm-hmm. And for some reason, does that then suggest that they are their own self-initiated documentarians? And in a way that once one is creating the work yourself, there's somehow a little bit of context which allows you to sit a little bit in the art world, in the art market. That's a commercial term. And some of my colleagues may completely disagree with me. That's how I would like to see it for the moment.
No, I think it's a very valid point what you're saying. Yes, it's a matter of disappearance of a medium or the transformation of a medium, kind of, or disappearing or trying to survive and the appearance of something else. But what I like what you say is about the documentaries is self-initiated. Well, with photojournalism, it's something that somehow you imagine being commissioned, isn't it?
I mean, certainly. When I began the work, and it was analog, it was film, it wasn't digital. So there has been a kind of reimagining into the digital, into the world that allows you to occupy space in a digital world. Yeah. But it also allows globally so many more people, so much more discussion. Yeah. And I endlessly talk about the deluge. And that's where I have a tricky relationship, I feel, with photography at the moment. Tricky, maybe more kind of, it puzzles me now. Yeah. It's way less exclusive and you would say that's a good thing. Mm-hmm. But then, so there are so many pros and cons, because you're looking at the quality, and then you're looking at the person who shouts loudest, who skips through the net, and maybe the quality isn't really there. But what, we know what we're talking about now. It's that our world is very different.
I was thinking of just what came to me was war reporting and the visual versus the word, and the visual arts versus the word, and their concept that, as a kind of writer in some respects, and knowing a lot of writers, they often have a frustration because no one reads, but they watch, they look. Mm-hmm. And documenting or photojournalism, I mean, there's a lot of your work, it's so varied. You do famous celebrities and artists, and then you do deeply political stuff and refugees and the apartheid and other oppressive regimes. And you could make the case that a lot of your photos and other people's photos, they put the big image out there. What was the image a few years ago when the baby washed up, and that horrific photo? And that was seen to carry so much weight because people saw something horrific and that changed it. Lots of people had written about it, maybe even documented it, but the power of that photo particularly. It's another interesting subject. And I think I would say, we mentioned, and you just mentioned, the democratization of an iPhone or a video camera and an image that's gone everywhere around the world. And then you look at someone who's got a great depth of craft and knowledge. Like mine is completely ignorant, so I feel a bit fraudulent talking about this, but I remember having a stepfather who was a bit of a photographer, and he had a darkroom, and he had film and things he cut up, and it was incredibly sophisticated, and props and lighting, and he knew a camera like a PhD type of person, which is you do this, and you must come up against now Instagram, social media, and I would also say a lot of these magazines are possibly taking people with less craft and knowledge, because it's a race to the bottom. They're getting a good image, cheap, it's okay, and then no one else knows the wiser. Would you say that also happens as well?
I think there are all kinds of things that have happened and have become really important. By the way, I did remember the little boy was called Alan Kurdi, I think. I seem to remember his name. Mm-hmm. But, it's a very interesting time in that there's Black Lives Matter, there's a call for, a wider showcase of whether it's Black, whatever minorities that have not been allowed to have their voices heard. And that's been incredibly important through Black Lives Matter, and whether gender, there's an extraordinary exhibition at the Tate at the moment with Zanelli Maholi, who's kind of bringing the voices for gender people. And I think because of that, and that coinciding with the power of social media, things have twisted and turned. They really have. So yes, I do see sometimes, have noticed that in some of the magazines, the quality may be lesser than. But then I look, and perhaps the person who's being showcased is somebody who didn't have a voice before. And maybe their vision is different, and it's important that it be shown. But what I also say, you talked about the word, and what I do notice is things like Facebook and Instagram, and for me not Twitter, but you could, the narrative has become something that you can't avoid. It's there is somewhere, somehow, in this fraught time and the deluge of images, I think the work that is noticed is having to be propped up by important narrative and by words.
Yeah. It's quite interesting what you said. I'm just thinking about what Adler you said before, that combination between the artistic and the political. But also to another point, it's about images and how images transform a dialogue or transform a narrative, so to speak. You know, how images that define a moment or define a political situation in particular. But I just wonder if you think that we, in certain ways, is reality that imposes the images on us. Because I'm not a photographer, I consume photography like everybody else. And that's the reason why, for example, I'm very optimistic about things like Twitter and Instagram, because what happens is allows us to become editors in that deluge that you're talking about, Julian. We become editors. So we follow certain people because we follow certain criteria. So if you have a Twitter account, I will follow you because you will be showing me photographs which are interesting to you, and I will be interested in the images that you are interested in. But I'm not going to be interested in everybody's images, you know what I mean? But the other thing is this about how reality imposes images on us and how we react to those. The editorial process that we all do with your help, you know what I mean?
Yeah, I hear what Andre is saying. I mean, there is always going to be a place for the image that's going to be that powerful and that iconic that it's going to change history. That I don't think is ever going to change.
Yeah.
Thank the Lord, you know, and thank, you know, whatever powers that be, that those images will stand the test of time and shift things historically. And so that, whether it's the photojournalist or the documentarian or the portrait photographer or whoever who manages to create that visual archetypal image that shifts things, there'll always be space for that. And I think what's happening, though, is there's so much, and there is so much in that deluge, is that we're jostling for the space. Yeah. That's okay. What I think that's going on. You know, I remember I got an award at the Royal Photographic Society, and Tim Berners-Lee was being awarded that same night. And I have never forgotten that he came up to me so we're talking about, because I think it was when I won the Visa d'Or. And he came up to me, and there was no reason he would know who I was, or I certainly had never met him before. But I remember him saying, you know, I am very concerned. I hope this creation, the World Wide Web that he just created, it's not abused. And of course, we know what we've suffered, and we've also contributed, and we've managed to, you know, have learned from it so much, you know. So it works in many, many rich ways.
I mean, the human being is just magnificent at rationalizing and arguing and presenting cases that when they're intelligent. So it's quite a hard one. I was just thinking then, I had the pleasure of walking around in an art gallery with a very esteemed painter, and he said, "What do you notice in this room?" And he asked me lots of questions. I was trying to give good answers. Okay. And he was okay. Yeah. He said, "What are you noticing?" And he said, and obviously I wasn't quite, you know, coming up with the right answer. He said, "People stop at quality and they move on quick. They stop at a story and an image which is arresting." And he's a classicist painter. And I think that possibly is part of what we're discussing as well. You know, people can scroll, they can scroll down, but they stop whatever it is and they go, "Wow, wow." And partly it's what the subject is, but then it's also how it's been taken. So someone such as yourself and other people who have been up close to various things of great interest, you know, Truth and Reconciliation Commission and other political events, I guess what I was trying to say earlier was there might be 150 people there that day, but in that 150 people taking the photo, there'll be two or three more masters who have served big, long apprenticeships, et cetera, such as yourself and other people, and that will be the decider.
I think that's what the other aspect that we ought to address is the fact that with digital, everything is much faster and hurried. And the analog, for example, the setting up a tripod and setting up a 4x5 camera, which is what I did with The Truth and Lies, and then my next project, which was about the Sangoma, the traditional healers in, on the Lesotho South African border, and the work that I did in terms of portrait work, it was that thing which actually slowed you down. And it's that that you're talking about, is that a qualitative practice. And it's very hard, actually, because sometimes even I struggle to get back to that moment where it allows you so much more to view the subject matter and go and to really focus and create the image in a much slower frame of mind than what you're doing when you're working with a digital camera. That's my feeling.
Do you think that that speed has changed the nature of the photographs too?
Yeah, I do think it has. I think it really has. Mm-hmm. I think it's quite easy for me to tell, I think, though everybody always says now, it's the size of the pixels and the great, how much pixels are in this image. You can't tell the difference between analog now and digital. You can.
I was going to say just another one. In the photographic world, does a photographer kind of sort of secretly or overtly seek out an amazing image? Like, do they kind of, is that kind of one of the grails? Like, I'm thinking of, the wonderful picture of Che Guevara staring off into the distance, which I don't know who it was taken by, and I don't think it was taken, and he got it and he was lucky and it was off the cuff, but that person gets known for this photo. Does that come up in the photographer's circle, so to speak, that they go, oh, that's so and so, he or she took that? Does that happen?
Oh yeah, absolutely. And of course now I'm biting my lip because I should know who it is, and I do know, but the moment it's kind of, it's fled out of my mind. But it would have been one of the Magnum photographers.
Yeah.
And of course, one is very aware of who would be responsible for those kind of images.
And this idea of happy accidents, there's a lot of ideas about photography that is about being in the right moment at the right time, lucky with the lights, with the subject matter, et cetera, et cetera. How much do you subscribe to that idea, Gillian?
No, I think it's absolutely true. And I think it's that premise. I mean, my first photo editor who used to say to me, you're as good as your last image. Or like a writer who will say you need to, it's a muscle that needs to be exercised. And the truth is, you're as good as your last image, carrying on and doing the work and being driven to do the work. And also, it's important that you know when you're going out there. For me, there has to be a kind of, if one is pursuing something that's meaningful. And now it's not good enough to just be going out to take a photograph. For example, in the pandemic, lots of people said, did you respond? Who responded? How did you respond? Yeah. How do you respond? There are a million people taking pictures of people with masks on. Which images are going to really stand the test of time and say it in a different way? That's different. Yeah, yeah. That's not so easy. And I have seen, there have been some photographers who've done it and done it very, very well and done it in a very kind of beautifully qualitative way.
Yeah.
My response was I started taking two things. I started photographing people with their masks on and then asking them what it meant for them to be wearing it. So for me, you see, if you want to call me the photojournalist or the documentarian, I want to know the reason behind. I'm much less of that person who will just create the beautiful image. I want to know what is the reason, what's the integrity, where's the stuff behind it. So, and then when I couldn't respond, I started going back into my archive and I decided to reimagine the archive. And maybe because it was so gloomy, I thought that what I wanted to do was entertain. So I had a lot of work in a project called Affinities, which was about creative collaborators. created collaborations, people who met because of work and began to work in beautiful collaborations together. Yeah. And I had done, I had revisited the project because I hadn't been able to get an exhibition and I wanted it to be somewhere in some fabulous
venue. Absolutely. We can look at some of those photos, Gillian, if you allow us. The one called Affinities, which is, I think is a fantastic piece of work. You can talk to us a little bit about some of the photos here.
A lot of these are taken in the 90s, and I didn't visit the project until recently. I started probably in a moment where I was, I didn't have work. And so I started wondering whether Gilbert and George, for example.
Yeah, Gilbert and George. I was thinking about it. Gilbert and George there, yes.
The second one, that one. And I wondered... I actually bumped into them. It's the one in the second row, the first with the suits. If you click on that one, the three men, that one.
Yes.
And I saw them in Arles in the photographic festival, and I asked them if I photographed them today, this is 18 years later or something, would they choose their cleaner, Saint and Forrest, who's the man in the middle? Yeah. And they said, actually... in fact, he'd either gone, I'm not quite sure if he'd gone back to the Caribbean, or I don't want to write him off, but possibly he may not be alive, but they were working with his daughter. Yeah. And so I made a plan to photograph them again. So that was quite an interesting. So for me, it was looking at the fact that the affirmation of friendship and how friendship endures.
Yes, indeed.
But the project that I created during lockdown was that when I went back to photograph a lot of these people, I filmed them and I had never shown the films. So what I did was I included the film, the music that was relevant to the people I was photographing, the photographs and documents. I'm talking about archival documents, whether it was because people don't communicate anymore with letters, with postcards, with facsimiles, with we're all on computer all the time.
Yeah, everything digitalized, yes, indeed.
Yes, and because I'm such a hoarder, I kept the postcards, the letters, the photographs, the telegrams, the facsimiles, and I created just a 3 to 4 minute narratives using music, film, archive, and documents from that time, up to date.
Yeah, but it's almost like you wanted to complement the image, you know, to make it more wholesome somehow.
Yes, yes. Mm-hmm. So that project on my website, if anybody wants to look, is so I was with my children and we came up with this name called Behind the Colorama.
I said there's a series of videos in there.
Yes.
You put them on Instagram as well.
I did. Yeah. I did. Yeah. Some of them were taken down on Facebook, a couple of them, because you have to pay to clear the film rights. I could go back and argue that it's called fair usage. There's something in film called fair usage, because I know that because I'm making because I've been working on a feature documentary.
Yes.
That's... Michael Clark.
Michael Clark, the dancer, the choreographer.
And that was taken in my studio. They were great working partners. And what I'd love to do now is go back to, for example, Michael Clark. I know who's just working. I've seen his name around and see who would you choose today? Because our exhibition of this work in Lisbon in 2021, which is great.
Yeah. Just for those who don't know, Michael Clark was l'enfant terrible of the British dance scene in the 90s, wasn't he?
Yeah. The next one under it, I think, is Allen Ginsberg.
Yeah, Allen Ginsberg. Here you are.
And the story of that photograph.
Let me see if we can get Allen Ginsberg here. Yes. No, let me see.
That's Jim Jarmusch.
Jim Jarmusch. His movies. I'm a bit of a Jim Jarmusch fan.
Okay. And this is Ginsberg with Hal Wilner. I don't know who Hal Wilner is. I have no idea.
Wilner was a music producer, and they were great mates, and it was in the Bowery in New York. And the reason, if you look at the writing over...
So I was going to ask you about that, yes.
Okay, and even at the bottom, he says for Jillian, and he writes Tiger. It is the start of the digital era, really. And I started working for the first time with somebody who was a technician when there were great, huge, the kind of, it wasn't like you could do it on a laptop. Yeah. And I said to this techie guy, Allen Ginsberg has written for me, and can we put his writing over this image? And that's what, so it was a sort of, a kind of homage to the new digital era. It's shot on a medium format, probably my Hasselblad, and then it's got Allen Ginsberg's inscription in the photographic book that he gave me.
So this is Ginsberg's own handwriting, then.
Yes,
there you are.
It is.
Yeah, incredible. Yeah. Okay, fine. And this couple next to it,
they are an extraordinary.
Are they the artists who cover the buildings with grass and lawn?
Yes.
Hedda Ackroyd, yes.
Mm-hmm. So that is, gosh, you're so knowledgeable, Juan. You know everything.
No. I used to work for the British Council. That's the thing, you know. Yeah. Yes.
So those are
the large brain, yeah.
Of course, I did shoot it in color as well, that image. And I did it all on large format. But I chose that one. And it was something about the way that movement of their bodies, there's something kind of incredibly, it just is as if they're really, that word of collaboration, which I was trying to get, and there's something very...
It flows.
There's another project here visiting your work, Gillian, that I want to talk about. It's about this young men called Young Men's Worst Fears.
Yes.
Because I want to go back to the Truths and Lies. I think it's an important work.
Yes.
But I want you to talk a little bit about this project.
Okay, so this project began, I was mentoring for a charity called Wembley to Soweto, and it was set up by a guy called David Westhead. And it was, I think he has a great interest in football, which, to be honest, is not my greatest passion, but I find people...
Fair enough, yeah.
But I was mentoring young girls and young men and women who were at the Arsenal and the Fulham football grounds. First it was Fulham, and then it was Arsenal. And I would talk to the guys, and I'd say... I don't know what's going on here. But
so are these boys footballers, is what you're saying?
No. These are people, some of them are musicians, some of them are models. It's a real kind of hodgepodge.
Thanks much.
But if you scroll down, for example, these guys are the guys that I met at the Arsenal football. What I did ask them is, we were talking, and then I said one day, all the stories I'm hearing is about absent fathers.
Losing my mother.
Yes, sorry.
Losing my mother, knife crime. And so I said, well, I'm hearing this story all over. And they said, yes, this is our experience. And when I'd asked them what their worst fear was, it was almost like they would just let go and start wanting to talk about it. And it was as if there was this huge sigh of relief when somebody had sort of suddenly identified what the problem was or what their common issues were.
Mm-hmm.
So I just started working with these young men, and then I'd ask them what their greatest fear was. And and the answers were pretty extraordinary.
I think this is so inspiring. My generation being defined by our apathy in the present. I mean, it's such a beautiful poetic phrase for a start, but it has so much weight and power behind it. And I guess, you know, the younger generation, the millennial generation, up until recently have been maligned as being apathetic and non-political and not interested in things. And I would say that that's actually...
Not anymore. I don't think that...
They would like to be... They look at contemporary politics particularly and can't identify with the the division, separation, and nastiness that it entails. And I think it's also a generational thing. So that's my opinion, but to not be defined by our apathy will be heralded by some people I know.
But also, by definition, a project like this becomes a project of youth male identity, doesn't it, Gillian?
Yes, absolutely, and that's exactly what it was. And sometimes I've questioned myself, why did you work with the men and not the young women? The truth is there were more men than there were women. And I was fascinated, probably because I raised my kids largely myself. So I was interested in that idea of absent father figures or male figures. What that does, because I so very often would say to myself, in terms of the kind of in the nurturing and the raising process, your son, he's going to be different, or you're going to create. And of course, there's so many other kind of influences, in terms of peer group and social, that can have so much of a mark. And there's a little bit that we don't have control over, really.
Yes.
But now,
let's go back to the first question. Is this photojournalism, or is it a kind of document in itself? What do you think? Personally, I think it's more of the latter, but I don't know.
I see it as a document.
It is more like a document, isn't it? Yes.
Absolutely. Yeah. And this is Josh, without skipping a beat, said, I just hope that my daughter doesn't get raised the way I have been, or doesn't see what I've been seeing. What's so interesting is it's not far from where I live, his areas. It's not very far. That's the extraordinary thing about London, as we all know. You can turn a corner, very different. It's the wonderful thing as well about this city. And it's the glorifying it and the fearful side that it can be, that you could just turn the corner and something very, very different.
Yeah. A question probably a bit callous. How safe is portrait photography? In this sense, Vivian, we are fascinated by faces. And it seems to me that sort of like, if you have an eye for photography, obviously you have, it's kind of easy to interest people on a human face, whatever the human face is, depending on how it's captured. Compared to abstract photography that requires a composition and something else, an atmosphere, with a human face is something that we kind of relate almost immediately to it. Do you know what I mean?
Yes, but I would powerfully argue
that is not safe.
I don't know what you mean by safe.
Safe means that it's kind of easy to make it interesting.
Of course, it's muy facil.
Muy facil, yes.
I don't agree, because I think that it's about, of course, if I give you a camera and I gave Andre a camera and I gave anybody else, and it was the three of us, every single one of us will see that person. Let's say we're talking about Casey in this photograph here. Every single one of us will see that photo, that boy, that man differently. And it's so much about how you choose to edify or make it completely a level playing field, about how you will light it, about which camera you will use, about which lens you will use, about whether you'll go low, whether you'll go high, whether you do his back or his front. There are so many that I can say that if it's the same as if you were quantifiably looking at a landscape that you wanted to show to you, it's about those choices. It's about those choices, and it's about what you know in terms of the practice and the years and years and years of experience you know what I will bring to it. Yours may be very different, but I know now I know where I'm going when I want to and when it's not working. Instantly, quickly, I know how I need to turn it around, I have to light it better, or what I need to try and make this image work.
I often return now to this concept of craft and experience and education and background, because when I look at this photo now, and listening to the both of you, I find this, I wouldn't have had what I'm just about to say if I hadn't listened to the both of you, which is, I see this man, Casey, and that he's pensive and thoughtful and contemplative in his face. And then the quote under it, his fear is losing the local sports facilities in Islington. Yes. So the word, the phrase, and the photo and the image are completely congruent when you look hard at it.
Yeah.
And I guess just maybe even going out on a tangent, I think when I go to art galleries, I'm often the sort of the ignorant one there. But what I tend to do is I tend to really like to take my time and look at things. And I find that people just go very fast through them. And I know that's my 20 pence worth there. But, yeah, so this photo here, I don't know if I'm making sense to you or not, but it's very congruent. He is, oh, he's playing football, and he's in a football jersey, etc. Yeah. But for me, he's very pensive and contemplative. And no doubt you've looked at that. You might have taken hundreds, I suspect, or thousands, like a writer does, and you've culled that all down to find that look on the face. Is that right?
Actually, I didn't. I mean, I took very few photographs, and that is on my medium format Hasselblad, so it's film, it's analog. I probably didn't take more than, so there are 12 frames on one roll of film. Mm-hmm. And I think I didn't take more than two, and I did a tiny bit of digital. So that was it. There were probably 30 images to choose from. So that's not a lot.
Maybe what I was saying was, different. But then when I look at that, I won't realize my dreams. For me, just as a person who's
that's a very interesting photo. I find it very interesting. Yes,
quite a lot. I think, well, that's very clever, because you're showing light and candles, and there's light in there, and that comes with the connotation of dreams, etc. Would I be bullish to move it on? But I don't want to.
Well, before we move it on, I wanted a specific question. I was thought about it to ask Gillian before the program. And is this idea of the fake news, obviously, and how much photography or the image, particularly with the digital era, has suffered from this idea of the fake news, the whole idea of the post-truth world. Look at Quincy's photograph, which I think is amazing. It's fascinating. It's brilliant. Is he aspiring to be a Shakespearean actor? Is he dreaming to see himself being as a Macbeth, playing Macbeth for the Royal Shakespeare Company, coming from the council estate? But imagine that I'm a callous, unethical newspaper editor, and I take that photo and I turn that photo into something like gang culture in London and, kingpins of the drug world and stuff like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, the thing about photography is that we can create our own narratives, even if those narratives are completely, completely distorted. You know what I mean?
Mm-hmm. I think that there's too much of calling out fake anything now. I don't think people don't have a chance. I know last year there was quite a high-powered photographer who was called out instantly for having apparently simulated something which wasn't true. And so you don't stand a chance, I think, really.
Okay, so people know, people will notice. Good to know. I'm glad that that's the case, actually.
Sorry to interrupt, but in fact, in the World Press, when I judged it, the first year that they had a portrait section. And it was very much like you produced your raw images, and then you had to produce the retouch you'd done, so that if there was any chance of kind of
misrepresentation. I don't know, miss.
Yeah, a misrepresentation. You would be called out in a shot.
Andrew, you wanted to move on.
There's a vault here, and I thought, you know, if we don't mind going on to the truth and reconciliation.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do that. Let's do that project. Yes, indeed.
And obviously, because I'm a New Zealander, and Gillian was, born and raised in South Africa, and I always think, maybe a little bit arrogantly, that we know more about some of the apartheid dynamics, et cetera, than a lot of Europe. I mean, particularly in New Zealand, we studied it. We almost had a civil war over apartheid in the 1981 Springbok tour. And the world actually really doesn't hardly know about that. Anyway, but if we get to these, just to marry it in and maybe go back, I was thinking it is a question and an intriguing one. Growing up in apartheid, and then your ancestral background of Judaism, so seeing a lot of oppression, persecution, and that, was that a catalyst as a young lady to pick up a camera, or were you just always liking images and taking them? Was that a partial catalyst to becoming a photographer?
So I think there are a number of things. My early memories are of being subject to kind of visions of great man's inhumanity to man. Mm-hmm. So my mother had trained as a social worker, and she was working in some of the townships where people had been kicked out. I'm talking about District 6. And she was doing a lot of work in those areas, and I would often go in with her. I also was aware of black people had to carry a pass so that if they were stopped by the police, could explain where they were meant to be, how they were, what they were doing. Basically, this kind of incredible infringement on human rights and utter perpetration of human rights and an unconscionably appalling system of oppression. And my early memory was of most white people had, because everything was always in racial terms, had servants, and us hiding my lovely, her name was Gertie, and Ben, he was the guy who looked after the garden and lived with Gertie. And I remember we had to hide them so that the police couldn't find them. So those early memories made a huge impact on me. And then on the other side, my mother she was an academic, a social worker, and she was very interested in, she collected old maps. So she created a business which was around cartography. So the visual thing was very, and collected paintings. And so the visual thing was very kind of important. Another thing that I discovered much later, it didn't occur to me, was that there was a very, very, very powerfully good woman photographer who worked in the area of Cape Town. And that was unusual. And I know that I noticed her, because I even have a photograph that somebody found when I was probably about 5 years old. And in this photograph, there are many people at this garden party. And every single one is looking at the birthday cake or the birthday present that's being opened. And I'm the only one who is looking up at the photographer who's photographing the scene. So somewhere along those lines, it's the political situation, visual from home, and it's that. And I went to university and did a whole BSOC sci specializing in sociology, social anthropology, social work, psychology. No sooner had I finished traveled and worked on something related to family therapy, thinking I was going to be a psychologist, I kind of did a turn, and I had started using a camera when I was on the campus of the University of Cape Town. And when I took a year off after I graduated, my companion was my camera. And when I came back, I worked as in this, it was called the National Institute for the Crime and Rehabilitation of Offenders. And while I was working there, I used to go and into the townships and photograph my clients who were all ex-cons, ex-prisoners. And by the end of that year, I had decided I would be a photographer. And I became a press photographer there. And that was quite, I worked as an assistant first and then became a press photographer. And during, you know, going from whether it was death row in the people being put on death row in Pretoria to protest marches to, you know, I remember the photo editor once said, listen, lovey, he said to me, I've got a very important job for you. There's one person, you've got to go and visit him. He's been, they've let him off. In fact, he's got life imprisonment. He hasn't got to go to the gallows. And the other one, and I want you to photograph that family really rejoicing. The other family, the guy is going to be hung tomorrow. I want you to get very sad pictures.
Oh my gosh. Incredible. Yeah, you are. Yes, of course. Emotional manipulation. But would you agree with the notion from what you just said that photography started as the initial motivation was justice somehow? An element of justice?
Yeah.
Would you say that?
Yes. I think that's very well put. I would agree.
And looking at these photographs also, Gillian, it's quite interesting. You're trying to be neutral, but we can say morally neutral, politically neutral. There's a kind of neutrality in these photographs. You are not making a statement. You want the photographs to make a statement for us. Do you know what I mean? For the camera, take the photo, and that's it. Don't make any judgment, almost, in the way that photographs are.
Exactly that. So I was photographing perpetrators and victims. Yeah. And I wanted to show as much dignity. And as you say, it was almost redressing the kind of incredible imbalance, you know, in my mind. So it was, as the Truth Commission was giving everybody a platform to tell their stories. And it was controversial because there were people who felt that it was selling out, wasn't telling the true story. But in the townships, I would say, I don't know why it's not going bigger, I wonder. In the townships, you know, most people were saying, at least now I could tell my story. I mean, this is an extraordinary, this is in KwaZulu-Natal. Her son was murdered in those woods. And this was in the, and she had come forward to the Truth Commission, which is how I found her. But and this was a very complicated situation because it was great conflict between the KwaZulu-Natal kind of Inkatha and the ANC. And a lot of people felt that conflict had been stoked by the South African underbelly, undercover of the White Guard, you know. And her son was one of those young men who was a victim of the conflict and killed. Uh-huh. And often it would be if people discovered that he might be an informer or that he, you know, had ratted on somebody. But it was a powerful image for me, that one.
Yes. Wow.
It's anything, a Truth and Reconciliation Commission is a high ideal and an extremely powerful thing to do. I mean, you could make the case, that America needs this to really move forward at the moment.
Many countries.
I was very lucky. I studied restorative justice in New Zealand, and I was one of the youngest they had, and it's implemented in our criminal justice system, but not very fully. And when I saw the Truth and Reconciliation in South Africa, I mean, it's so deep, Gillian, huh? You know, an offender taking responsibility for what they do, the victim articulating the awful suffering which they have endured. It's not easy in any form. And I could imagine I mean, just real courage to do that process. And you were live and direct with it, with Desmond Tutu.
This is an interesting story, this one, because this is a woman called Charity Kundile, and that was her son. And he was put on it's a horrible story. He was tortured and killed, ANC guy, and Der Kutsir, who was this white part of the,
ruling elite. Ruling elite.
The names just escape me for the moment. But he was the first person who came forward to tell this the story of this undercover, underground white guys who were...
A whistleblower or something.
Yeah, he was like... But Charity's son was put on a funeral pyre. And then Der Kutsir told the story about how long it took to burn a body. It took 7 hours. God. And then he said, and we drank beers and we had they called it a braaivleis, a barbecue, while the body burned. So he could say exactly how many hours it took to burn the body. And the extraordinary thing for me was that there was another image that I was going to use, which was this woman with such dignity in this beautiful white suit. Coming out of this little, tiny little shack in a township with all the power and dignity that she could hold, which blew me away, really. And the image, if you click on the image of the man with the gun in his hand, and I was photographing him, and he invited us to his house just outside Pretoria, which is the executive capital and the place where these guys operated was a secret place called Flakplaas. And he was preparing this, the whole place was under barbed wire and fenced in. And he kept making these cups of tea with us with this little, very dainty teacups and china, you know, kettles.
Yeah.
And he had this purse that was sort of strapped to his arm. And I said to him, what is that? I see you go, you have it everywhere. And he said, yes, I must even take it to the toilet. He said, it's my gun. And I said, well, do you mind if I photograph you with your gun? No, he said, I could. But I thought there was this bravado of a man.
It's quite interesting. Of all the photos, this is a photo of the man who prepares to make a statement for himself with a gun, isn't it?
Yeah.
Don't mess with me. Almost to be the body.
He was terrified. That's the point. He was so...
He looks terrified. He looks terrified.
He was really scared. His whole point was that gun had to go with him behind the barbed wire and the fencing and the... And even when he went to the toilet, he had to take this gun to the toilet in case somebody came to finish him off. That was his mind. And it was this tragic set of, you know, the violence begets violence. But by the way, a very interesting thing, Joe Biden, there's a very interesting, if you Google Joe Biden and apartheid, he made a rather impassioned speech about it, which you should have a look at.
This photo blew me away when I saw it the first time. And tell us about this photo, Gillian.
So this man was called Reverend Lapsley, and he had been the ANC chaplain in Lesotho, and the South African the apartheid government had hunted him out, and they'd sent him a letter bomb, which went off.
And oh my gosh.
Blew his hands off. The interesting thing is that
I
gave that image. This is okay, so here's me expressing my bad, is that I gave Time magazine that image, but I thought that I would crop the image. It's something I never usually do. I thought it would be very powerful if I cropped it above the calipers, the hands, where the hands would have been, and the cross. And I would give them that image. And I think that Time magazine reproduced it. And I got the call from Reverend Lapsey. And he said, don't reduce my disability to a disability. He said, don't ever, please,
Don't reduce my disability to a disability. Incredible.
Can I? Yeah. It took me a while to actually see the hands, actually, because I was I was looking elsewhere. So was he a liberation theologist then? I mean, Juan being a South American, you know about the murdering of the liberation theologists. Was he a liberation?
So he worked for the African National Congress, and he was the reverend. So people obviously would come to him. He was their yes, exactly. So
I would imagine so. Oh, there are elements of that. I mean, whenever you go to repression in a major scale, either the church or the representative of the church, part of the element becomes politicized.
Yeah.
And part of that church also takes the side of the underdog, of the oppressed. Mm-hmm. And obviously he was with the ANC and with the oppressed.
Well, I actually think the current Pope was initially a liberation theologist.
Because
Argentina went into basically hiding, actually.
Yeah, he was an
interesting man to talk, because I, you know, me having very little knowledge of religion, but when I was in South America, that really stood out to me, this, you know, idea of liberation theologists getting murdered by often this same Catholic Church. So the church split into two. They either supported oppressive political and army forces, and then they didn't. So, no, that just struck out to me. I mean, gosh, I mean, and then he says, don't reduce my disability to a disability. This man, and I would say your work as well, is coming from this place of extreme compassion under such a, you know, adversity.
Yeah, I mean,
because the human reaction for revenge and bloodlust is enormous. Yeah. Like I would say, like the man with the gun. I mean, you know, to carry a gun and not be able to fight, so to speak, without a gun. Yeah. I mean, this guy.
Yes.
And that tautology, don't reduce my disability to a disability, is just so well said, actually.
Isn't it?
It is for a man whose hands have been blown up by a letter bomb sent by his political enemies. You know.
So he, funny enough, Andre, you will love this, because I've just taken the book. Father Lapsley, a New Zealander.
There you are,
for you, was a pacifist when he arrived at the University of Natal. But, he explained to the Truth Commission, I realized that if you were white and did nothing to change the situation, you were actually a functionary of the apartheid government. He was deported from South Africa in 76, went to Lesotho. He joined the ANC and trained Anglican priests. In 83, he moved to Zimbabwe, where he was denounced as the ANC's chief external ecclesiastical propagandist. After the release of Mandela, he received a letter bomb believed to be sent by a government death squad. He lost an eye and both hands.
Yeah, I mean,
oh gosh, yeah, the, what a story.
This whole, well, yes, he's a New Zealander. I mean, that's nice. I mean, I try and now get to a point where I see beyond all sorts of things, religion, color, nationality, and I know this sounds very trite, but go human, you know, because you're human beings, they have an infinite capacity to be awful and violent, and the other side compassionate, and that is an amazing story. Like it just alerted me to this idea that, you know, Nelson Mandela went from being a terrorist to a freedom fighter, and many of the governments, you know, the conservative government, particularly in this country, as I understand, under Thatcher and other regimes, were pro-apartheid and did everything in their power to keep that regime going, like other regimes. And then when Nelson Mandela was back into the fray, he was a global saint, he was a freedom fighter, he was a high messiah, all of these things. And then when he died, I think very few journalists actually alerted people to the fact that, you know, David Cameron at the time was working in someone with around Thatcher, and they effectively were all, you know, supporting the regime. And then your photo there alerts us to, and the history of This is a man who basically said, if I'm not part of the, what is it? I'm not part of the solution, I'm part of the problem. Incredible. I would like to see this, actually, this, particularly this Truth and Reconciliation, major gallery somewhere, in a major gallery under, yes, under the title, maybe a bit more general, of just oppression.
Is that Desmond Tutu, Lilian? Sorry for interrupting. Is that Desmond Tutu? Desmond Tutu? Yeah, okay. Fine. Sorry, Andre, sorry, continue, sorry.
No, no, I mean, I've said my piece. I mean,
It was bothering me what they were called for some reason. I haven't looked at my book for a while, but it's the joke, the man with the gun. They were referred to as the counterinsurgency unit.
The intelligence unit. Yeah, that's the, you know, yeah, always the counterinsurgency unit.
Yeah, so I kept thinking, like, what, did they have a very special name that I, but that they were like a special counterinsurgency unit. And, well, And the woman that you saw before, she is very interesting because her name is Joyce Mtimkulu, and this was it was quite a shocking image to take. That was the hair of her son. And what's amazing is that, as you know, in South Africa, that that sign almost is like the power salute, the back. We had photographed it. We had it in front of her, the hair in front of her. And I knew about the hair because I'd seen a very disturbing television program when the man who supposedly murdered her son had arrived in her house asking God knows what for, some kind of, you know, forgiveness. And he was in her home when somebody came and threw a brick, I think, which almost kind of hit his head. It's a rather extraordinary piece of footage. Maybe you can, I'd quite like to look and see if it's on YouTube or something somewhere. But she was very angry, and understandably so. And that holding the image, you know, enlarged her this kind of dignity and power at the same time. Because again, because we talk about the 4x5, the tripod, the analog, because it was slow, it allowed me to, I think, slow down that moment, capture that
image.
That image.
I mean, they are. I mean, this is such a marvelous use of technology, and what a terrific idea, Juan and Jim.
Yeah. I mean, but I was thinking,
they are very, they're so arresting.
Mm-hmm.
And they definitely document and bring to life more, well, I don't know, the word does as well. Obviously, the word is extremely powerful, but I mean, just to see those two images. I mean, the labor.
But I'm thinking about the concept of dignity here. Three things: tragedy, injustice, and dignity. And how dignity in your images, Gillian? I see dignity as a response, the only intelligent and humanly possible response in the circumstances against a gross act of injustice, which is a tragedy, obviously, or against tragedy.
I'd love to, because I wrote a diary of this image, and it says, if you don't mind, Mrs. Mtimkulu held up her son's hair, which looked as if it was still attached to part of his scalp. Her husband sat in a corner, his head bowed. The front room of a modest township house. It was into this room that Gideon Nivot would come to ask the family's forgiveness for his role in their son's death, bringing a camera crew to film the proceedings. Simpiwe's son, which means remembrance in Xhosa, did not like Nivot's advances to his family. This was the brother. Nor did he believe in forgiveness. I watched his arrival on television. He drove right up to the house, armed with a missile. I think it was a brick, maybe a flower pot. He found his target, took aim, and the camera shook a little as the object flew through the window and connected with the side of Nivot's head. He reeled. The blood began to gush freely down the side of his face. He looked mortified, as he aborted the peacemaking enterprise and left the home. The reason the hair is there, that they had in when they had detained her son, Piwo, he was fed rat poison, and that's why the hair fell out. So there you are. And if you want to, the other image in the series is of that man who Nivert, who also purportedly killed Steve Biko, the Black Consciousness lead.
Ned in New Zealand, I remember. Yeah, I was too young to really get the gravity of it, but it was all over our news. Steve Biko,
yeah,
and then there was this amazing song by Peter
Gabriel. Peter Gabriel, yeah,
more resonated. But I think I might have been 10 or 12. Look, the violence and awfulness in Africa and all other parts of the world is just it's so horrific. And you think of these. I remember going to Pol Pot's killing fields, etc. And the same thing, though. There's certain types of human beings who, through fear, usually are prepared to and will do horrific things to other people. And you just then there are other people, human beings, who go, you know what, kill me, I'm not doing it. So, and they exist too. And presumably this lady's son was one of those, these kind of characters that must have existed all through the terrible suffering of apartheid. Yeah. You know, that colluding characters who then, in the sense of being the white people there, got to, in many respects, sort of ask for forgiveness because, the privilege that they had. And then to the whole idea of forgiveness is such a difficult thing to do. I mean, I think forgiveness is about yourself because you're like this image, this lady. She's got hatred, justifiably, towards something. Her real forgiveness is actually trying to cleanse herself of that.
But here's something much more complicated. Okay. Collective forgiveness, which is a very difficult enterprise. And I think that, again, I mean, I will go back to the concept of justice. I think, for example, Gillian's work in the same, I see it as a spectator and hearing the story that Gillian's telling us. You are acting against the injustice, but what kind of injustice? Forgetfulness, not forgiveness, forgetfulness. Forgetfulness is an act of injustice. We now know the story of this woman and her son because of the work that you did. So it's about this. It's about not forgetting. It's about keeping the memory of these things. It's interesting, in Spanish, the other word for photography is instantanea, the instant. So the photography is timeless. So this story doesn't go away. This story will be there. And I think that's the beauty of it. My question to you will be this. Two questions. One, just mundane and technical. For how long did you work on this project? And the second one, more personal. What was the most difficult thing that you learned from this project?
So I worked from the time I came up with the idea to the time it was published. It was at least 5 years.
5 years. Wow, that's a long time.
Yeah. Oh, wow. Yeah. Almost every project that I work on that has any significance or any meaning is not less than that, I feel.
It was an on and off project, Gillian. Were you in South Africa most of the time? All those 5 years, you were traveling in and out of the country.
I was going backwards and forwards. And okay. That was probably because I had a lot of work here happening in the UK, the US, Europe. Yeah. I was also raising my children, and so it was very much backwards and forwards, and that was difficult because obviously there were sort of these hearings happening all over the country, almost like kangaroo courts happening anywhere at any time. Yeah. And I suppose my luck is that I'm lucky, and my timing has always usually been bloody brilliant. But of course I couldn't, it's one of me, and I couldn't follow every single. So I didn't, of course, part of me would have loved to have been able to be there for every single one, but I wasn't. I got, okay. I'd say, a lot of the major ones, but okay. Not always. I would sometimes, miss out on some because of going backwards and forwards. What I learned, that's a very difficult question, and I don't know that anybody's asked me that before. I learned that whatever happens, if you have something that you're absolutely driven to do, it doesn't matter if anybody tries to put you off, you have to go for it. That's number one. And that may sound completely trite and banal, but I did learn that because I determined to do it and I persevered to do it through thick and thin. And the other thing was that the very difficult moments, and there were many, many, in terms of arriving at an understanding and acknowledging people's frailties, vulnerabilities, and their bravado, and that I would keep to that thing that I professed to myself and promised myself in the beginning, that I would show some kind of objectivity and try and be neutral in the image taking. And I think that I managed that. It was very, very difficult. And sometimes photographing people who hadn't dealt with their own emotions and vulnerabilities and fears, and I'm talking about even and specifically perpetrators, was quite terrifying, really. And so it was about just keeping level-headed and going through those fearful moments, really.
Mm-hmm. Do you think, are we ready to sort of maybe move on to towards the end? And if someone said to me, well, Gillian's photographed everyone who's everyone. So when I looked on...
Commissioned one,
and I saw on the Instagram and your website, and I was thinking, oh my God, there's Leonard Cohen, and there's...
Yes, everybody, yes.
And this actress, etc. So I'd say, yeah, the world of celebrity and promotion and portraits that your job, you know, entails and can be about. And, I mean, me... when I saw, you know, Leonard Cohen, there was one of Leonard Cohen, and I thought, you know, you've had these experiences with some of these, you know, great people and great artists, and you have to.
Can I interrupt for a minute? Can I just call Juan that it's in commissioned? If you go
it's to commissioned, yeah, okay, a portrait.
Yeah, sorry, Andre, sorry.
There's a lot here, isn't there? Because now we're entering sort of what you could say the different world, so to speak. If you look into social media and Instagram, you don't see what I don't see much, truth and reconciliation commissions and depth of stuff. We do more see, look at me, this is me, I'm good looking, I'm beautiful, this is what I'm doing.
I'm successful.
The people you've had the privilege to and worked hard to get their portrait, you know, people of gravitas and the arts, et cetera. And I was just wanting to ask you how that process is, whether there's a confidentiality side to working with people who are prominent, and what's your sort of reflections on this part of your, you know, portfolio?
It touches on a little bit that we touched on earlier, which is about the fact that, you know, these sort of people, these influences are photographed by many, many different people. I'm stopping right there for a moment, but just
because... I really like this photo.
That's an interesting picture, because if you were going to be simplistic, you would almost dub Horst von Wachter, whose father was a man who, I think, killed... Yes, his decree meant that 300 or 600,000, 300, 600, it was a huge amount of hundreds and hundreds of thousands of Jews killed in Poland during the Second World War. His father was Hitler's lawyer, and he died in the arms of somebody he was secured at the end in outside of Rome. Bizarrely, I mean, there were people who were sheltered by the church, but Horst would not tell us, would not admit that his father was a bad man. He, literally, I mean, it's just, you know, again, if I say that and it sounds simplistic, but he would not. He had a shrine to his father in his Schloss, which was just outside Vienna. He was in absolute denial that his father had done anything.
And this is his slush outside Vienna? Is this his house?
And this is the house. And I had to photograph photographs that his mother had taken in the Warsaw ghetto of Jews with, you know, with Star of David armband and very hungry, you could see. I took photographs that she'd taken of Himmler and Hitler and in her photo album. And wow. as we were leaving, his wife, Horst's wife, said to me, as I was getting in the car, she whispered in my ear, she said, "His mother was a Nazi till the day she died." You know,
so probably, yeah.
And in fact, if you look at, I was there with Philippe Sands, whose book East West has done very, very well. And he's made a documentary about it.
And the Rat Line as well, isn't it?
And the Rat Line, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But it's fascinating, this photograph. It just makes me almost think that implicitly he's recognizing the guilt of his father, even if publicly he will not admit it, in the way he's living. Look at this almost Spartan way of living. Spartan in a kind of decay sort of thing. So it's an unhappy surround. It's like this is not a happy, homely home. This is just a grandiose relic, antique, falling apart. It's like the guilt of his father is represented in that photo, in the way it's captured there. For whatever he wants to say, you know, in the way he's living, look at that. Look at that's the house. Probably those books have not been read, probably, you know, all leather bound books, but probably untouched for years and stuff.
I actually quite like the old shabby.
Yeah, I like the shabby, but I do think the shabbiness is a demonstration of the guilt of the family guilt.
Superficial. I actually
incredible photo.
Not the man.
And this is this was in a speech about the Ku Klux Klan. Her husband, the photograph she's holding, her husband told her to hide with the children in the barn, while he fended off. Protected, stayed in the house in which was set alight. So he was killed in that fire by the Ku Klux Klan, and she had gone and hid with the children in a barn in the back. And so it was really spooky to see that, you know. It was in Alabama or Montana.
And this is for Life magazine. Which year is this, Gillian? Because Life magazine, going back to photojournalism, was the magazine of photojournalism.
Yes.
The 60s and the 70s was the magazine to watch, wasn't it?
I think it folded in about, if I'm not mistaken, at the end of the 90s or in 2000, there, about there. So this was done in about 97, late 90s.
Okay. I mean, great photo. And it reeks of, that's a terrible word, reeks of, you know, great craft and lighting, etc. And it seems we've been on a bit of a narrative here of that people who kill human beings because they're different to them. They have different coloured skin and different religions. And it just perplexes me as someone who likes difference.
it's just the barbarism. It's just the barbarism of it.
The Ku Klux Klan feature.
Yeah.
Yes. Shall we move on?
Oh, Primo Levi, I love this photo. I love this photo. It's just so good. It's one of the photos when I was looking at your webpage, one of the ones I think it's a great photo. This for which magazine was this? Where was it published?
Again, it dates me. So City Limits.
City Limits.
It doesn't exist anymore, but it was
it doesn't exist.
Early commissions when I arrived in the UK in the mid-80s. So it was in the 80s. It was 3 months before, or 4 months before Primo Levi died. And what happened is that I couldn't speak Italian, and his English was very poor. And we were in this hotel lobby in, I seem to think it was called the Durance Hotel. And then he lifted his glasses to clean them. And because I had one light and this shone on it, and I said, could you clean them again for me? I don't even know how I communicated. And he did it, and this image,
a brilliant photo,
he used a lot, that image.
Was the shadow of the spectacles intentional?
Yeah.
And well, we have to say that Primo Levi was a survivor of Auschwitz, for those who don't know, and then committed suicide at the age of 70-something, almost 80 years old, I don't remember his old age, which was very perplexing.
Well, there is a big discussion about whether he threw himself off the stairwell or whether he
fell. Yeah. And amazing photo, yeah.
This was... Commission.
Glenda Jackson, yes. I one thing that I was talking about with some friends about this, Gillian, about faces. And when you see people like Glenda Jackson, with people like who died recently, Diana Rigg, who I just admire so much. I was in love with Diana Rigg when I was 10 years, 12 years old. I was my first platonic love. I look at this British actress, and I love the fact that they don't go into the plastic surgery, Botox sort of things. Then I look at people like Jane Fonda, and even now, Nicole Kidman. And there's something which is like so disappointed to see those faces being manipulated, so to speak. Quite nice to see these faces. And I was thinking about when you see portraits of people like W.H. Auden, the poets, or people like Beckett with all the wrinkles. I find that those faces fascinating.
Speaking of that, sorry to interrupt, but Saul Bellow, almost like a concentric shell of wrinkles. But Glenda Jackson's got such a beautiful face and amazing cheekbones, I think. Yeah. And this could sound terrible. It's not meant to, but she's got that kind of William Defoe kind of lovely high cheekbone kind of appearance. Wow.
Great, excellent.
We walked away. So, should we have a few more? And
she's one of my favorite artists ever. I mean, Bridget Riley is so good. She's so brilliant. How long ago was this? That's quite a few years ago.
I think Bridget Riley. It may well also be late 90s, early 2000s. I'm failing to remember 2000 and something. Yeah. Like maybe 2003 or 2004, somewhere around there, maybe later.
Yes.
Alan Parker,
who died not long ago, didn't he?
He did. And in fact, you can see him talking in my Behind the Colorama.
Really? Okay, I'm going to look at that one. Okay.
Because it's really wonderful. The film bit is right at the end, but it's great.
Well, you know, the Behind the Colorama series on Instagram, I you know, again, we're terrible. We just can't critique you at any stage, Gillian. It's going to continue. I think they're terrific. They're these little 3 and 4 minute pieces with these, you know, really exquisite narratives that sort of diverge into quite a lot of different territories in a very short space of time over a photo or they really are Behind the Colorama.
We could carry on watching. Oh, Rebecca Hall, yes, that's the daughter Peter Hall. Well, we could go for days talking to Gillian about all these photos.
Yeah, you did. I just didn't realize how big this website of yours is.
Yes, indeed. We better stop there because otherwise we will not carry on.
Sorry, I mean. Just because we're going to have to round up soon, maybe we can, otherwise we can spend maybe months going through all this. Are there any future exhibitions, et cetera? I mean, I'm kind of pleading for the Truth and Reconciliation one to come back somewhere. Are there any future ones coming up? I know that COVID might have affected quite a few things recently.
So Adrift, which is an exhibition that was going to be here in London between April to September and didn't happen, is going to be happening, believe it or not, in Vilnius in Lithuania next year, which is no bad place for it to kick off, because one of the other projects I've been working on now is a personal story where a whole branch of my family just disappeared and ended up in Ukraine because they were thrown out of Latvia. because they were Jewish. About those kind of things. And then another, the Affinities exhibition is going to be in Lisbon next year at the Rui Freer Gallery. Yeah. And at the moment, somebody's suggesting wants to me to have an exhibition in Beijing in
2021. Wow, nice.
As for Truth and Lies, I would love to have it again. The last time it was shown was in it was in Yunnan province. That was after it was shown in at the Nelson Mandela, the Mandela Museum in Johannesburg, and the Robben Island Museum. We'll see.
Well, I mean, they're all uniquely different locations. Lisboa is a beautiful city.
Yeah.
Is it Ukraine?
Vilnius.
You could do your passion for cold water swimming in Ukraine because you're up there. And China. And then something tells me Juan's got to set something up in Colombia.
Yeah, probably, yes. True reconciliation for Chilean to do in Colombia. The Colombians haven't done that. At least the South Africans are ahead. Very much needed in Colombia right now, I tell you, obviously. No, it's true. No, the importance of this work is fundamental. One thing about the truth and reconciliation, Gillian, just the book to start with, just the book. So the book, people can buy the book.
Yes.
And perhaps one thing that we can do is a link to the book where people can buy the book. It would be interesting to actually see a copy of the book. That would be good to have it. But the other thing is that to revisit it, because that was how many years ago, Gillian?
So it was published in 2001 or 2002, and Granter published it.
Oh, Granter. So imagine now, 20 years later, where the situation is, because obviously the some problems remain, changes, the nature of the problems changes, but certain things, that's something interesting, I don't know, I would find with these kind of projects. That requires time and energy and all that sort of stuff, yes.
I remember when I was working on it, somebody like Bernard Kushner, who I met in Kosovo, I remember he talked about wanting to use it as a model in obviously in certain places. And if I recall, I think it was Peter Gabriel who actually said, you know, we need a Truth and Reconciliation Commission in Ireland. And some of the models were used in parts of Latin America. There were people who wanted to.
Gillian, the model could be used in Chile, in Colombia, in Mexico. What is happening in Mexico right now? I mean, all this act of injustice is a first step to address an injustice. Mm-hmm. And the justice again, what is the justice? So forget what has happened.
Anyway, that all of these things are based on restorative justice. The principle.
Yeah, restorative justice is part of that process.
The perpetrator or the offender. And then the community get involved in this. It's really good. But anyway, okay, so just to round it up, on behalf of the program and Artefacto and ZTR Radio, we'd really like to thank you very much for the experience and the show and the interview. It feels like we could go on forever, but maybe another topics another time. But thank you very much, Gillian, for being who you are and allowing us to do the show. It'll be this one will be on, we'll put it on YouTube, we'll put it on Podomatic, so the visual and the auditory come along, and your website will be there as well. So many thanks.
Thank you so much. Thanks to you.
It was fascinating.